Welcome to Season 2 of the Y87 Podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. In this podcast, we will be talking to members of the Yale alumni community about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We will be exploring what they've learned, how they see the world, and what they dream of the future. This podcast is devoted to the idea that every life is remarkable. So we will be speaking to a wide spectrum of classmates and friends, exploring as many perspectives as we can. We hope you enjoy the podcast and it gives you something to think about. If you're a new listener, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. As you listen, please think about acknowledging the generosity of our guests in sharing their lives. Leave a comment, tell a friend, sign up to be a guest yourself. We'd love to hear what you think. Now, sit back and enjoy today's conversation. We hope you enjoy it. All right. Well, welcome to our next edition of the Y87 Podcast. With me is our classmate, Melissa Gilliam. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you. So what are you up to these days? What are you doing?
Yes. As of August 1st of this past year, I am provost at Ohio State. So left my home of Chicago after many, many years and moved to Columbus, Ohio.
Very exciting. That's a big change. Now you're at the Ohio State University, and full disclosure, I'm a Michigan Wolverine as well as an Eli. No, but a lot of respect for the land-grant institution. So you are the provost at Ohio State, is that right?
That is correct.
So what exactly is a provost?
Tim, that is a good question, and most people do not know what that is. So I have two titles. I'm provost and executive vice president. In the provost role, I'm the chief academic officer, which means that I oversee 15 colleges, over 7,000 faculty, and 67,000 students, the academic aspects of the lives of 67,000 students. And we have six campuses. And so I'm responsible for thinking about the academic excellence and success of all of those individuals. And then I'm also the executive vice president. And so that means I work for the president and have kind of a operations role in that regard. And so I oversee things like IT and our Office of Institutional Equity, our Office of Diversity and Inclusion leads strategic initiatives. So whatever is asked of me from an operations side, I also do that.
Now, you did not start your career as an academic administrator. You started as a doctor, right?
Yes. So I started as a physician researcher. And until 8 months ago, I was still a physician researcher with an academic component. I spent the majority of my career at the University of Chicago and really just was focused predominantly on scholarship and taking care of patients. I always had a smaller clinical footprint and always had some administrative role or another. And then as I went through, really kept all three of those going and then let go of the clinical part. So I still have a scholarly component and now I'm the provost.
So how did you make the journey from being a clinical researcher to being a provost? Because that seems to be quite a journey.
So as a physician, I focused on adolescence and reproductive health, initially through the lens of teen pregnancy and teen pregnancy prevention, so a pretty biomedical focus, and then increasingly realized that there are significant social determinants of health that people were less interested in addressing at the time. And so as I, and in ways that I thought were not only essential to address, but when it comes to adolescents and teenagers, you know, this kind of the deficit model and coming into a hospital because you have a problem, you're not going to reach the majority of teenagers and you're not going to be speaking to them in a way that they want to be spoken to. And so I realized I needed a very different approach to scholarship. And so in many ways that became more compelling to me, what I was doing in research, and was more compelling to me than what I was doing in the clinic. And so I slowly kind of shrunk the clinical footprint and built the scholarly footprint. But I always found that if I was running something, if I was in charge of something, I could work the hours I wanted clinically and have the time I needed for research and kind of keep things, had a better sense of how things worked, which enabled me to better do the things that I wanted to do. And so I got pretty good at running things and fixing problems and solving problems. And people would just ask if I wanted to run the next, you know, work at the next level. And so at some point I was asked to be a dean in the medical school, like an associate dean in the medical school. And then I was asked to be a vice provost in the central administration. And my research is always combined, you know, kind of thinking about human capital, right? It's your health and your education, that combination. I think most of us know how transformational education is. And so it was really that combination. So when someone said, well, do you want to work in the central administration where you're actually working on issues related to education? I sort of said, well, not really. And then I realized I would be working for an outstanding president and provost. And I thought, well, I'd love to see that up close. I wonder how that works. And so that's how I ended up in the provost's office. And then when COVID came, I ended up doing a lot of stuff related to COVID. I was doing a lot of lots of different projects. And I realized it was, universities are a great platform to do transformational work. You really can influence lots of people's lives and well-being. And so between whether it was protests for racial justice or COVID, I just felt like, you know, if you still have energy at this time and you have opportunities to do even more, then that's your responsibility. And so for me, that became the responsibility. And I looked at positions for provosts and said, this one at Ohio State can be incredibly impactful. So that's what I did.
Yeah, six campuses and 67,000 people. That's a lot of lives.
That's a platform.
Well, it is, and it's a remarkable platform. I mean, you think of all the different academic disciplines at Ohio State. I don't know how many departments there are, but because it's a land-grant institution, it must have hundreds. So what are you hoping to accomplish at Ohio State? What are the transformations that you have in mind?
Sure. I'm about 8 months in. So, you know, a lot of this early period is really getting to know the place. As you said, it's a big campus. It's a beautiful campus. I have cows on campus, which is one of the most exciting things.
Well, you must have all sorts of animals on campus. I mean,
We do. We have vet med and seen, yeah, it's really, and some days there are even llamas, I am told.
All right.
Yeah. You know, I think this is a complicated time and complicated time for this country. But, you know, I read a job description that said, do you want to address some of the major issues of our time, whether those are social inequalities or economic inequalities or health inequalities? And that's really when you're at a land grant institution that is in the state capital. We have these extension offices in every county of Ohio. That's really the opportunity. So the first year is really about setting up systems and infrastructure. People get so sick of me talking about that. But, you know, it's sort of the promise. If you think about a hospital with high quality systems and infrastructure, we can take care of your heart attack in one room and help you have a baby in another person have a baby in another room. And we're open 24 hours a day. And so, you know, the more we can really think about how we work as an organization along really important strategies, the more we can do. So that's really what the first year is about, is really setting us up to be a really great strategic organization. Watch out, Wolverines, right?
Well, fair enough. But it's funny with these schools, they have such spirit, which is fun. It's around the athletics often, but then it spills over to everything else in a way that I didn't expect.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like it before. You know, people who know me will say, what do you mean you've gone to every home football game this year? But indeed I have, right? It's part of what it is to be an institution like that. But yeah, the goal is really to make our students as successful as we can, to have our faculty create field-defining research, to take care of the state, the people of the state of Ohio, to do incredible workforce development, to really close student achievement gaps. And I think we can do all of it. So really excited about the work and the opportunities here.
So emerging out of the pandemic, or at least out of the last phase of the pandemic, are there any educational innovations that you see at a big institution that you think are actually improvements?
You know, I think questions like that immediately take people to the online space. You know, I think that's really one of the places. I think the opportunity there are, you know, it's kind of twofold. One is, how do we create a new type of flexibility that allows students, whether they are on in a remote area or they're out for the day or they have a disability, how do we create a seamless experience if you're on premise or if you're online, and how do we create that continuity of educational experience? COVID created one of the fastest transfer, you know, everyone talks about how slow academia changes. And suddenly we were within just weeks moving to an online platform and completely virtual. And so there are these opportunities to convene in different ways and to collaborate in different ways. So I think that's been one of the major things. And it allows you to think differently about who comes into the classroom and who comes into the learning environment and who gets educated on our campuses. So I think that's probably going to be the areas of greatest innovation, is just the how and why and where of teaching and learning. It will be a big part.
Yeah, and I also wonder about, you know, the creation of community, because obviously when we were ill, the colleges, the residential colleges, were so centrally important, and then sort of changed over time, and I think are a little different now than they were when we were there. And in a big institution, you have these big rallying points, but then I've heard or read about people trying to break down the community into smaller groups so there could be more of the social interaction that's akin to the residential college experiences that we had. Are you seeing things like that?
As a result of COVID or just in general?
Or just generally.
Yeah, I mean, I think just in terms of trends in higher ed, I would say, you know, when I was in a private institution and now I'm here in a public institution, this idea of the residential college and trying to create that experience of the residential college, I think it's kind of the holy grail of education. So many institutions look to it as a model that often, you know, they simply lack the physical infrastructure to create or to replicate.
Now, I've noticed that you recruited one of our classmates to join you at The Ohio State University. And no one can see the mischievous grin that went across your face. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the Yale class of 1987 is now going to take over Ohio State, but if it is, you've heard it here first. What was it like? I mean, getting someone you've known, did you know Charlene?
Did. It was kind of the best thing ever. You know, when I first got here, it's a very different place than the University of Chicago and this idea of having regional campuses. So I wanted to go and visit some of our regional campuses. And so one of my colleagues was kind enough to drive me, and we're driving back. And he said, you know, we once had this great dean and director of our Lima campus, which is our most distant campus. And I said, oh, that's great. And it's in a small rural town. And he said, yeah, you know, this great Black woman named Charlene Gilbert. And I thought, well, how many Charlene Gilberts could there be? And I was like, I know Charlene Gilbert. And so I'm on my phone and I'm like, is this Charlene? And he said, yeah. And so I had gone through this. One of the first things I did was a kind of an assessment and a reorganization of my office. And someone said, go after Charlene. And I said, I'm doing that. And so it is just, I mean, it's just fantastic. So as I said, I arrived in Columbus in September. She was at the University of Toledo. I called her in December and she started, I think, probably in February, maybe March. And it's just been fantastic.
What's it like to work with someone that you, who you've known for so long?
As you know, hiring is really hard. It's very, very difficult. And you have to find people to work with that you can really empower to do great things. And it's just been fantastic. You end up with somebody, you know, is incredibly smart, is incredibly thoughtful. And every once in a while, you sort of say, and I remember when we were taking a class with bell hooks, you know, like you'll have this recollection of something that someone said when they were 18 or 19 years old. It's fantastic.
Oh, that's great. Now, you know, you've got the two of you at Ohio State as senior leaders. You've got Tamar Gendler.
I didn't even put that together. That's so exciting.
Tamar Gendler is the dean of the faculty at Yale. You've got Rosario Ceballo, who's now the dean at Georgetown, who had spent many years up in Ann Arbor, by the way. And Jennifer Collins is about to begin as the president of Rhodes College. So you've got all these women in our class who are the senior academic leaders. And I know of a few of the men in our class who have done very well in academia, but nobody who has gotten to the places that the women I just named did or have so far. I think it's pretty remarkable, and it's just notable of how many of the big academic leaders in our class are women. Why do you think that is?
I'll take a guess at this, and I appreciate hearing how many people are doing this work. You know, these are places that have given us so much. I can speak for myself personally. You know, I've been in school since I was about 3 years old. It is an absolutely amazing environment. But you also know what it's like to be part of an environment that was not necessarily made for you. Even schools and institutions that had women from the beginning were not always tailored for the needs of women or underrepresented folk or other people. So there's both kind of a gratitude, but also sort of a sense of being able to see how these institutions can be more accessible and can do more and serve more people even better. And so I suspect it's that when you look up and you've in these institutions and you get to a certain level and realize that you're one of the few people in an institution that is has made it to this level and has developed those skills, you sort of want to give back and make those opportunities available to other people. So I don't know if that's necessarily, if it's a gender specific thing, but I do think the fortune and the sort of the sense of good luck that happens with all of that, you realize that there's an opportunity to share it with others.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you are enjoying the conversation. As you listen, please think about acknowledging the generosity of our guests for sharing their lives. Leave a comment, tell a friend, post about what you've heard on social media, maybe sign up to be a guest yourself. The discussions we have on this podcast are made all the richer with your participation. Now, back to the conversation. You know, I mean, just observe, I don't know everyone I just listed that well, and some not at all, and some better than others, but they all seem to be the kind of people who just get shit done. And I don't know, that obviously is not a gender specific quality, but that seems to be a quality that came from the women in our class who went into academia, which I find remarkable and laudable. Did you know all the people I just listed? Did you know them in college?
I think I knew many of them, but I'd have to kind of go through and look at photos just to double check. So it's really exciting. Yeah. And I think it's sort of the get it done and also leave the doors, windows open for others to follow and come on in as well. So I think that's the twist there is like, while I have an opportunity, you know, to try to make a path for as many people as possible.
The other thing that has struck me is that, and obviously was sort of just a note for me in differently than it was for the women in our class, was that Yale hadn't actually been coeducational for very long when we showed up. My grandmother went to the University of Michigan. I have her 1921 yearbook with me. So like I grew up in a place where, in a family where, of course, women went to college, because if you said otherwise, you know, Grandmother Krause would have a word with you. So, but, you know, we didn't go to an institution that had that reflex, and there were still a lot of alums who were in the early 80s not particularly welcoming as I look back at some of the old yearbooks and whatnot. You know, it's just, I don't know if that had anything to do with what motivated people to make sure that there are more open doors for others.
Yeah, I mean, I feel on the one hand, I feel super fortunate. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and there were women and people of color in every walk of life. I just helped to come from majority minority city. I was surprised when I realized that these things were rare. And then my mom had gone to college and to graduate school, and both of my parents and also my grandfather had gone to college. So I had also had a sense of multi-generational college. But what I didn't realize was that it was so rare. That was what the surprise was. And then both of my kids ended up at Yale. And when I just saw how much easier it was for them than it was for me, like how, you know, just figuring it out and how much of that pathway I created and had to figure out. And then realizing that it's much easier if one generation does it than it's easier for the next generation. That was the surprise. And I think that, yeah. Always really interesting how privilege is handed down from generation to generation. And I think that's the key, is we can do this for so many more people. It's knowledge, it's systems, it's understanding how things work. And we can give that knowledge to so many more people, because talent is really everywhere and it's really well distributed, but not opportunity. And that's, I think, what that's about.
How does that learning that you just described so eloquently, like, how does that translate concretely into what you're trying to get done at Ohio State?
Yeah, so I will say from a very, and maybe, you know, this goes back to that initial question about, well, how do you go from a medical doctor and a researcher to doing that? So I have spent my whole life talking to young people, talking to high school students. And what I learned early on was they would come back and say, that thing you told me, you know, 6 months ago changed my life. Or I remember, and I'll give you an example. I had delivered one of the first deliveries I ever did as a residency. It was a resident, was the first delivery, was to a teenage mother. And I said to her, you know, this doesn't define you. You can do whatever you want with your life. So I was at a conference about 4 years ago, and someone like taps me on the shoulder and she said, you delivered my baby, and now I am a professor, and my daughter, the one you delivered, is getting a PhD in biochemistry. Thank you for what you said to me. So, right? It's like, right. So, and it's always been that way. People, by just seeing that someone can do something, someone that looks like them or doesn't look like them, or someone they didn't expect to see in that place, it makes so many things possible just by being present. So that's part of it. It's just, I know it makes a difference to people to see women leaders. It helps people understand what they can be. So it is very important that the president of our university is a female engineer. And she talks about that story a lot. I know that I help people understand what is possible at The Ohio State, but I believe in really diverse teams of lots of different and lots of types of people and getting lots of input. But even through those processes, we change ourselves and eventually we change others. So some of it is this deeply personal, representative and conversational thing that I think that can happen at institutions. But then we can build those insights into systems. And so what I didn't know about Yale and getting into Yale was just how you do it, what forms you have to fill out. But luckily I had a good college counselor who taught me that. And then there were other people in DC who had gone to Yale. And then my mom just put me in touch with them. And then I knew people in, you know, multiple classes, and I felt very much at home. But that's not everyone's experience, because you don't always grow up in a city where you have that. But you can be intentional about that. You can teach people the systems, the processes. You can expose them to college and college ready and college going behaviors from very early ages. And so that's the type of thing. And so they talk about the distance traveled. And I remember one of my college roommate, Laura Ekstrand, once said, I learned about college during my senior year of high school. Well, I learned about college when I was like 6 or 7, someone said, well, are you going to Harvard or Princeton? that was on my radar from a very early age. So that distance traveled, you can close that distance by just opening people's horizons and giving them that exposure.
So on an institutional level, how do you create the systems you just referred to do that?
Yeah, so the first is that you make information public and available and accessible. So people kind of laugh because I'll say, no, all announcements get made at the same time. No particular person gets special knowledge versus other people, because that's how inequities happen, is that some people have access to knowledge and to power and to senior people and other people don't. The second, so it's really thinking about making knowledge and information accessible. And then universities are getting very good at creating pipeline programs or pathway programs where you start exposing young people to schools, institutions, to campuses early on. So this can be everything from your local 4-H program to a summer academic program. And the earlier you start those types of summer enrichment programs, the sooner someone starts to feel a sense of belonging on college campuses. So we used to do this at the University of Chicago as part of my research. I would actually run large summer interventions on college campuses, game-based, so students, you know, young people were there to have fun, but exposing them to a college campus early on. And I remember I used to bartend at Yale reunions, and you'd see three-year-olds with Yale t-shirts, and you go, oh, that's how it worked, right? You know, like that early exposure to this campus, so you feel a sense of comfort and belonging, and then it's not surprising that you would apply there when you're ready to go to college. The other thing is that you have to make institutions affordable. And so today we launched we enrolled the first students in something that's called the Scarlet and Gray Advantage, which is a program to basically try to have students have a debt-free pathway through Ohio State. And so if you think about the magnitude and the scale at which Michigan, Ohio State, Berkeley, the magnitude and scale of these institutions, the lower the cost of tuition, again, incredible accessibility opportunities. And so that's actually why I ended up hiring Charlene, is that, you know, in institutions that are this large, you can end up being very reactive because every day something is happening. And I needed someone to ask these big strategic questions and work across all of these offices and silos to try to do exactly what we're talking about, advance academic excellence and academic success. So we're back where we started from.
I suppose we are. So let me ask you this. Are there classes that you took in college that still resonate with you? You mentioned bell hooks. Obviously, that's probably one. Including that one, are there other kinds of classes that were really formative for you that informed the way you want the classroom to work at Chicago or where you were, or Ohio State now?
Yeah. How much time do you have? Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I think I was moving so quickly through Yale, and then I spent a couple of years studying philosophy and politics, and then went to medical school, that it wasn't until I started back in higher education that I realized how much of an influence my Yale education had on me. And first of all, it's incredibly important because in my role, I work from everything from the sciences to the health professions to the humanities. And so having a really strong humanities background has been critically important. But I'll answer your question more specifically. The first is my research uses art and humanistic practices as a asset development approach with young people. So I work a lot through storytelling, design, and narrative and technology. And so that is really rooted in the work that I did at Yale. And the people who really embodied that for me, one was Jamie Sneed. I was an English major. So one was Jamie Sneed, and I don't know if people remember him. He was a Joyce scholar and was translating Ulysses into German.
As one does.
Yeah, I actually quote him often because as you remember, our freshman year, there was a strike. And so many of us were just completely empowered and organizing around this. And he sort of said,
7280, yep.
Exactly. He said, oh, good for you. He's like, you really think this university cares about you? And what he meant by that was, you know, what makes a university are the books and the buildings and all of these sustained things over time. And we hope you are happy enough that you come back as an alum, but you need to know that you as a student protester are being accommodated in the university in the same way that we accommodate the football players and, you know, someone who works for the Yale Daily News. This is your extracurricular activity, which was just, you know, like, ouch, but absolutely right. You know, this was a developmental moment for us, and the university had tolerance and kindness, and we're accommodating that.
It's funny because I got to say, I now look at it differently than that. Like, I can see that attitude. I completely get it. But I think it's the convening power. I think that's the power of all these institutions. You have the convening power to bring all these people together. And if I look at, did I learn a lot in college classes? Yeah, I did, actually. But did I learn more and on a sustained way from having lived with the people I live with, not just my roommates, but all the people? And the answer is yes. And it's the convening power. We're guests. And I still struggle with this. It's like, what's the role of alumni? If it's part of building a community, and that's what I see at schools like Ohio State and Michigan, it's not as transactional. And it's not about giving the money or getting your kid in. It's about, okay, I'm going to be part of the community and root for it. And I think that's healthier. And I think that's also part of what makes it special. Because I look at the convening power of any serious institution, and that's its magic. That's the secret sauce.
I love that. And I think that is something that I, boy, do they have it at institutions like this. Like Ohio State, that has been a really remarkable thing because it wasn't as big a part of the University of Chicago. That was, our traditions were stronger. You know, it was about, not our traditions, but our traditions were such, and our history and what we stood for and the way we thought, all of those things were really important. So that has been interesting. So Jamie Sneed was an incredible influence, just someone who just really talked and thought about how to think and how to be precise and how to write. And that stayed with me for a long time. I love, in retrospect, having had Gloria Watkins as a teacher in Bell Hooks, that again made an incredible and had an incredible influence on me. Oh my gosh! I just could keep going. You know, I took a great course in autobiography, and the great Claire Massoud was my classmate. And then my science classes, I had an amazing organic chemistry professor. I think his last name was Weinberg. But again, that just mind-blowing just to understand organic chemistry and to sort of see that type of enthusiasm. So yeah, what a great. And, you know, and I think this is the thing that you, one carries with you and is just known in higher education, is that Yale has great teachers. It is like one of the best undergraduate teaching experiences, and it truly is.
So we've gotten to the part of our podcast, what I call the lightning round. So I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions. If there's a college class at The Ohio State University that you have not taken ever anywhere else that you're saying, oh, gee, if I had an extra hour in my day, I'd go take that class. What is it? Mm. You go take the llama class? I don't know what.
No, I think I've been flirting with some like really basic, like, business finance kind of thing. But what I will say is that the beautiful thing about being the provost is I read. So I read tenure packets. This year I read, I think, 150 dossiers, and each one is like a class. And I read everything from political science to engineering to business to vet med. So I feel as if I learn every single day and I do not have to go back to a classroom. So there.
Fair enough. So is there any pizza in Columbus, Ohio that rivals New Haven pizza?
Nope.
Right answer. I usually don't grade the answers, but that one I think I can grade. So I think we'll leave it right there. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak. I think that the people of Ohio and the students in Columbus are in great hands and really, really appreciate you taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
In a world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings, one Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while. An in-person reunion, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022. We will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. It's one Yale College class dared to break the mold. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.